My name is Harley Stroh, and I'm the line editor for the Goodman Games Dungeon Crawl Classics. And you are about to enter the dungeon of the Vorpal Network. Snickeder snack. Roll for initiative.
Hi, my name is Matt LeBeau, and I just won two sets of Elven Dice by listening to The Tome.
Welcome to The Tome, Episode 82. The Tome is a D&D news, reviews, and interview show, and I'm your Tome host, Jeff Greiner. In this episode, we sat down with the old sage of Shadowdale himself and got the lowdown from Ed Greenwood at Origins 2008. Okay, so I don't have much to say to start off this episode, other than, you know, the usual. So here's the usual. Forums, vorpalnetwork.com, and Amazon Store. You can fill in the blanks from there, you've probably heard it enough, unless you're a new listener, in which case, welcome! Now, with the new Forgotten Realms campaign setting book already out, and the Forgotten Realms player's guide coming out right around the time of this recording, I figured this was a good time to bring you an interview that myself and Jeffrey D. Wynn did with Ed Greenwood, creator of the Realms at Origins 2008, and rest assured there'll be reviews of those books coming along shortly. He had some very interesting interpretations of the Realms that might be quite a bit different from what you expect. He explains why the Realms are, in fact, not hurt as a vibrant, exciting, and fun game world just because there are severely powerful NPCs running around. Plus, he gives his ideas of how the world looks in 4th edition and why he thinks it works alright. And he also updates on some of his other projects. So, here we go.
So, we're here today with Ed Greenwood of all kinds of gaming fame. Ed, what did you do before the Forgotten Realms? That's what you're well known for, but clearly there was life before the Realms.
I was six. What I did before the Forgotten Realms was eat, sleep, read everything in my father's den, eat, sleep, cut the grass, duck housework, go to school, read everything in my father's den. Okay. Lather, rinse, and repeat. I was 6 years old.
So at what point in time did gaming become a viable career choice?
Oh, gaming came along much later, because the Forgotten Realms started as a fiction world.
Right.
And it was for my own entertainment. In those days, gaming was something done in Britain by a guy called Donald Featherstone, who wrote these cool books about how to do battles with Airfix plastic soldiers, how you painted them up, mm-hmm. and then he had these neat little skirmishes, encounters between one side and the other, whether it was tribesmen rolling rocks down on British armored cars in some part of the occupied Empire of Britain, or whether it was civil war in the United States between the blue and the gray, or whatever it was a small set-piece battle with a few plastic soldiers, and he actually told you which sets to buy and how to paint them and how to put them up and how to do the, yeah, okay, for this game we need a hedge and we need two hills, here's how to make them, you know, and it was that's what gaming was. And then gaming became also this weird thing that you saw with hexes and all these little squares with intricate stuff on them, and then you read the rules and it was like attending a legal class. Rule 1.1, case rule 1.2, mm-hmm. no three hex stacking except across rivers and zones of control. What? You know, but it was, that was gaming. Role-playing gaming I hadn't encountered yet. The Realms I was just writing as a world, and it was a career. I mean, there are some who could argue it still isn't a career. I mean, I'm still working in libraries. I make, what little money I do make is usually from novels rather than from gaming stuff. Mm-hmm. Gaming stuff is, well, yes, you get paid for it, but you do it for fun.
Right.
I mean, if you wanted to get paid oodles of money for writing stuff, become a lawyer and write legal briefs. There, you get a lot more money for a lot fewer words. Mm-hmm. But I don't look at it that way. I think I started earning the majority of my income from gaming around 1988. The Realms took off, and I was writing stuff faster than I could live. You know, everything else slid to get all the information that TSR wanted for the initial launch of the Realms. Everything took second fiddle to turning out stuff for the Realms. And there was one year when TSR was in financial trouble just before the Wizards of the Coast thing, where I think I worked on 11 products that year. And I still had a day job that I commuted to 100 miles to my library job, but 100 miles home, and worked on 11 products. So it was like, I didn't even know what my own name was most of the time, let alone the stuff I was working on right now, which product it went in. That was their problem. I was just, yeah, I'll give you, oh yeah, information on the Red Wizards thing, cool. Information on the Seven Sisters, yeah. Oh, I got that. What elements, okay, yeah, I want it. You know, but you do it for fun. I mean, I think everybody, whether they're making a career out of gaming or whether they're just doing it as a gamer, in the end, is doing it for fun. There are far more reliable ways to make a lot of money in this society. They're not as fun, most of them. The ones that are as fun generally turn out not to be totally legal. But you know, if you wanted to just make money, buy land, sell land. But you know, and make all the right choices, play the market. But I mean, that's not fun. We want to have fun that where you interact with other people, and hopefully around a table that either has your cool imagination dancing in the middle of it, or a really cool board, or cards, or something, or little figurines, or all of the above, where people can walk by and say, "What's that? Looks really weird, but looks really cool." Yeah. And that's what I want to be part of. But you know, I would say 1988 is when I started making money from it. Yeah, back then.
So you started writing for the Realms back when you were six. How much of the stories from then still ring true to the world that ended up being developed later?
They still fit, but the original Realm stories, they were right at the level of you walk into a bar and you meet this guy with a long beard and his name is Elminster, and something really cool is happening with a confrontation in some other corner of the bar and you don't know what it is. Whereas now, these decades later, you know the flows of trade and commodities between all of the different countries. Mm-hmm. You know the prevailing tidal patterns and weather patterns. All this stuff has now been codified, not just in my head, but it's been set down somewhere. So somebody can argue about the prevalent rocks in Scardale.
Sure.
Or pick up a fern and say, oh, no, we can't be in the Dales. We must be somewhere south of the Dales because look at this fern. You know, and that really wasn't part of the original Realms. I was always into super detailing, but the early Realm stories were really about people, and they were from the vantage point of somebody discovering it as they went along. Because I was.
Right. Sure, like a lot of authors do when they create worlds. Sure. So over the last 30 years of D&D, the realms, I imagine, have taken turns and diverged from the original realms because the property is owned by the gaming company.
Mm-hmm.
In what ways has the realms changed from the original vision that you created?
Well, the first big change was that in the early days of TSR, two of the designers were real history buffs. And they put in real-world historical echoes, Mazteca, Karatur, and then later the entire campaign line of El Khadim, the Arabian things. And to that extent, they were far more, they echoed far more closely real-world stuff. Right from the beginning, Doug Niles had been working on his own Albion quasi-English campaign, which became the Moonshaes. I had Moonshae Isles, but they sort of replaced them with his continent and so on, which had far closer to Norse people than I would have had in, far closer to Celtic people than I would castle names starting in Caer.
Which is interesting, because you look at the stories of the Moonshaes, and it feels very different from the rest of the realm.
And there's nothing wrong with a regional feel, but I would never have been that close, because then it somehow, it gets people into thinking that what they've read of, say, King Arthur or the Celtic matter of Britain holds true in the realms, and that could make them make a wrong role-playing decision in play, because they're using information, lore from outside the realms, and thinking it applies in the realms, because you've sort of led them to expect that. Right. Same thing with if you're talking about the celestial bureaucracy, or I think the low point for me is when somebody put the Dalai Lama into a realms product. It was like, no, that's... Thank you. Now, the Dalai Lama is a really nice gentleman, but he's a real person. You know, we shouldn't be doing this.
Sure.
You know, particularly not without his permission. You know, he's, let's not. You know, I think that's a bad design decision. So that was the first thing that it really diverged. And then as the novels took off, in those days novels, there's always been this tug of war between novels and games in the realms. Are the novels deciding things, what we call realm-shaking events after the fact? You know, in a novel, somebody wants to kill a god, create a new one, destroy an entire kingdom. Then the game designers go, thanks, because they now have to rewrite everything for, you know. And who decides that tug of war? Who's doing the first pull? Who's in charge? I mean, I'm not an authority type guy. I find that whole idea abhorrent. But on the other hand, if you're publishing a game line, you do have to have somebody in charge making decisions.
Sure.
And it's been very uneasy over the years how those decisions have been made. Sometimes it's worked wonderfully. Sometimes they've been what I would call happy experiments, but where we didn't know what was going to happen. It worked out fine. Sometimes not so much. But that was always the where the points of divergence would come, because somebody would say, oh, in my novel I want to do this. Well, that has a big game implication, but to go ahead and do it, then you have to... You see, if you're writing it in isolation so it doesn't affect anything else in the world, it doesn't matter. But if it's one big tapestry and you decide, say, second edition, you're going to kill off all assassins. Bingo! All across the realms. Assassins go... They're all gone. Okay, it has an impact on the societies, on the stories, on what's going on. Those are the sort of things that changed throughout the years, and that's how it diverged from. But there were all sorts of parts of the realms that I hadn't really super detailed because my players hadn't gone there. What we knew of certain areas really is what the caravan merchants from that area told people about what happened, or other people with all the stereotypes and racist comments and so on that might have gone on, or just plain exaggerations, would say, oh, you know, in Thay, they eat babies, you know. And the guy telling you that is not from Thay, and you hearing it are not from Thay and have never been there and probably never will be there. You're in some tavern in Upland Cormyr, you know, and the stories spread because, hey, if you're buying this guy drinks or dinner in return for a story, he may want a good dinner. He may embellish the story.
Sure.
He's center of attention, you know. And therefore, you get things said about kingdoms that, other than that, they weren't really nailed down anywhere because I hadn't developed them. So it was more developing them along with. And then as the years have passed, somebody would say, okay, I'm setting my next novel and say, Ed, tell me all about Thay. Boom. I grab everything I got in my notes, then I start adding because I know what he's going to need to do in the novel.
Mm-hmm.
You know. How is the social network set up? How do these people live? If you have that many slaves in the society, how does it affect the price of slave? What do you do to a slave? Is a slave worthless? Can you work them to death? Or are they valued commodities? Because the slave has a skill. The slave can turn a lathe, can turn stuff out on a lathe. So you want to keep him. So how are you allowed to treat him? Can you just kill him wantonly out of hand because he's yours? Or are there laws about this? You have to work all that stuff out.
Sure.
So by that process, throughout the years, every little corner of the realms has had more painted on it.
Okay. So you spoke a little bit about realm-shaking events.
Mm-hmm.
With 4th edition, we seem to have the mother of all realm-shaking events going on, plus a 100-year jump. How does that impact your work, then, as a novelist, as a game writer who's contributing to the Forgotten Realms campaign setting? How much does that diverge from your original vision of the realms?
Well, it's increasingly, of course, diverging because over time. But I don't view it so much as a divergent because I didn't have a shining view of the realms that doesn't change. Mm-hmm. My view of the realms was, this is a real world where things are happening and it's developing and I'm just watching it.
Mm-hmm.
No, I'm discovering the realms as it unfolds. So it's not so much diverging as I'm going along for the ride and seeing what's happening. You could say it is the mother of all realm-shaking events, but what is really happening that is a realm-shaking event is the spellblick.
Right.
All that's really happening, in addition, is rather than give you a blow-by-blow of 5 million realm-shaking events as this god changes, this part of the world changes, they've jumped ahead 100 years and said, we're not going to cover that. except as we need to in retrospect in novels or so on and so forth. Mm-hmm. In the games, we're not going to give you a every 10 years buy this box set, you know, here's what's happened. This, you know, we're just going to move ahead 100 years. Okay, and here's the new norm. And we tell our stories in this.
Okay.
So it isn't a campaign reset button in that they're not saying that all that stuff back there didn't happen. It did. It still holds true. We've just jumped. We've stepped out of the realm's timeline. We've walked ahead 100 years, and now we're walking back in looking at the realms mm-hmm. again. So in terms of how it changes what we're doing, we're changing everything, but we're not rebooting the realms. We're just moving ahead.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason I think that we're not doing great detail in that 100-year gap is to give enough freedom to the designers and writers that all sorts of new people can get in to do it without going back through 30 years of stuff. Because there will be people in the company, the editors, and people like me who, when somebody says, oh, this guy's just put purple frogs in Symbia. Okay, so they're now purple frogs in Symbia. Sometimes during 100 years, they appeared. Why did they appear? Well, we'll think about that. How much does he have to say in the novel? Okay. In other words, we're back to what do I need for the story right now to make the story cool? But I want to emphasize this. I don't want it to negate all the history of the realms mm-hmm. that you've built up over those decades, because that's the one thing that sets the realms apart from most of the other gaming settings. We have developed this history.
Right.
So I think the best way to look at it is, in school you get taught a lot of myths about American history, Paul Revere and stuff like that. If you really go back and look at what really happened, no, it didn't happen that way. But the myths still have value. And stuff that happens today in the real United States of America is still informed by what happened through all those centuries of development up until now. I mean, you have a White House, you have parties and so on, and they all have a history, and they can all point back at things, whether they're doing it accurately or not, or whether they're emphasizing things to support, it doesn't matter. They can point back at a history that is how we got to where we are today. And we're doing the same thing in the realms. We're just 100 years of it we're not covering. We're jumping over. But we're not entirely jumping over, because you'll see in some of the Transitions novels, Bob Salvatore's Transitions trilogy, it's actually called that, but there are other Transition books as well that are covering it. What Richard Lee Byers is doing, what Thomas is doing, all of these people are writing books that sort of slide through into the new post-Spellplague realms, and they will mention things that happened during that gap.
Okay.
The next writing I'm doing, I fully intend. I mean, next writing, because the last Knights of Mithrandir novel will come out, which I've already finished, before you see the next thing
sure.
I write. But I'm not sort of saying, okay, forget all the old realms, here's the new realms, blah, blah, blah. No. Everything that will be informed by will build on what went before.
Okay. So new projects that you're working on then are set in that 100 years later period, or are you still doing things previous to the Spellplague?
I think the next things you'll see will be post-Spellplague, 100 years on. But they will refer to stuff that's happened, and maybe even have flashback scenes, because we're sort of tinkering with what we should concentrate on first.
So are we going to get an explanation as to what's happened to Elminster in that 100 years?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Oh, yeah. Now, like everything you hear out of Elminster's mouth, it may not be 100% reliable. He may be leaving stuff out and distorting other stuff. In the same way that the bearded mage smiles out the window of the car and says, "But officer, I have no idea how she got in the seat beside. I've never seen her before in my life. Doesn't she look nice? But I have no idea. And I have no idea how she came not to have any clothes on either. You'll just have to ask her. It's nothing to do with me." there could be some of that, because Elminster has always done some of that. You know, there's always been this sort of disingenuous, "Over here. No, you should have been looking over there."
Yeah.
It's a horse of a different color. So there's nothing wrong with that, because it's A, fun, and B, it sort of reminds you, don't trust everything here out of this guy's mouth, which gives a dungeon master full license to say, well, it isn't that way. What do you mean you read some book and it's in it?
Yeah.
Well, oh, that was written by that lying bastard Elminster.
Yeah.
No.
So Elminster's role for the last several decades has largely been as a chosen of Mystra, defending magic and trying to get magic out there into the world, that kind of stuff, as a follower of the goddess of magic. Mystra's dead now.
Mm-hmm.
How does Elminster continue to fit into this world?
Well, that's very interesting. You think that's what Elminster's role has been for all these years, but remember, everything you knew about the Forgotten Realms, with the exception of a few comments dropped by Laurel in Stephen Shen's study, and one visit by the symbol who wasn't really in a very good mood at the time and might not want to trust anything she said, everything you've heard about the realms has come through Elminster. That's what Elminster has told you. Okay? With that little caveat. Yes, definitely things are different now. And things are going to change. Yeah, I have heard, and I have even read, that Mystra is dead. There are a lot of things written down that you know, you should take with a grain of salt. However, this could be correct. You know, Mystra could be dead. But then, dead to a goddess is not always the same as dead to the rest of us, as we've already learned. But then, everything's changing. So I don't think that Mystra's fatality would be the only fatality amongst the gods. I think you're going to see big changes. But then again, we don't yet know the full implications of those changes because we haven't quite seen it yet. And, you know, we've all, to go to a real-world example, we've all come to elections and heard speeches from politicians saying that, you know, if elected, this will happen. Really, trust me, watch my lips, or whatever, you know. And then 3 or 4 years afterwards, didn't turn out that way. You know, so I'm not saying Mystra's death didn't happen. I'm not saying Elminster's role won't change. I'm saying it's too early yet for us to trust anything about what might actually happen. You'll just have to wait and see. You know, I was actually thinking of writing a novel called Elminster Must Die. And one person in the office said, oh, you can't ever call it that. And somebody else said, oh, that's the most coolest title I've ever heard. So,
they used a similar slogan for a recent run on DC Comics.
Okay.
Jimmy Olsen Must Die. Okay. Tagline.
Oh, well, actually, what was said from the next desk, apparently, I only heard this imperfectly over the phone, was, no, again. As in, Elminster must die again. You know.
Well, and that brings up the point. I mean, you mentioned that Mystra sure is dead, but doesn't necessarily mean gone.
Mm-hmm.
Had me curious because I looked. You know, Mystra's died before. It's sort of a regular occurrence in the realm that Mystra dies and then comes back. I was just curious. This would be the longest period of time.
Well,
or at least without her being overt.
Well, okay, I don't mean to imply that Mystra, the person we know, the goddess we know, is not gone. She is. I mean to imply that what happens amongst the gods is when a god dies, other gods take over the portfolio.
Sure.
And they may or may not admit this. Like, you may go on worshipping Mask or whatever, and somebody else is granting the spells, but the faith, the Mask, is still strong, and mortals don't know that Mask isn't... I'm just making up an example,
sure.
Okay? But on other occasions, it'll be, oh, yes, where before you knelt to Mask, now you kneel to me.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, the thing that everyone tends to forget when discussing this is not like real-world monotheism, where you have to believe in one goddess or god and not in the others. Everybody believes in all the gods, all the time. They may not worship them. No, geez, I'm a tinker. I don't know anything about Umberlee, and I don't need to. I don't go to sea. But then, of course, if the tinker ends up being swept out to sea by, you know, a tsunami, you may hear him shrieking prayers to Umberlee as he bobs off across the waves because it's suddenly important to him.
Yeah.
Okay, and that isn't sacrilege. They all believe in all the gods. They just don't necessarily support them all in the same way. So I guess what I'm doing is in a very, you know, roundabout and annoying way, is telling you, I don't know. It's too early to tell. It's too early for me to tell.
You're right.
And therefore, it's too early for me to tell you.
It's not too early to know.
Yeah.
Because the campaign setting's been written.
It has. but you see, it's a living, growing, breathing world. It doesn't stop. And certainly, they haven't stopped writing novels.
Mm-hmm.
Lots of novels. There are novels being readied as we speak for the New Realms, and they're going to be different. So it would be too early for me to say, because even the act of giving an answer that gave a particular impression would... It's sort of like if we're standing in a huge rotunda with doors all around us, and each door is a story, and each door is standing open, you've got all these stories. And if I say the wrong thing, I'm closing a whole bunch of those doors.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't want to do that yet.
Leave it open so the author can tell the best story.
Yeah.
You bet. I always felt bad for this incarnation of Mystra, because it seems to be the longest reign of godhood in the history of the world. You know?
and
Avatar's trilogy, she becomes a god, hangs on. It's been, what, maybe 15, 20 years, and then she dies.
And she hasn't had much fun during those 15 or 20 years. I mean, it's really terrible, because all we have seen is really through the eyes of Elminster. Mm-hmm. So, of course, what it looks like is she went to bed with Elminster 15 times, then she asked him how she was doing, and then she's dead. But, of course, that's just what we're seeing through Elminster's eyes.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it could have been quite different. And one of the things I will very briefly be showing in the next Knight's book, which, of course, you know, everybody should rush out and buy, because it's the best book that I wrote.
Naturally.
Yes.
Ever.
Yeah. It's called The Sword Never Sleeps. And it's about swords that don't sleep and all sorts of things. But one of the scenes is Kelvin and Elminster in a ruined castle somewhere arguing about what they should do, both as chosen of Mystra, about a particular thing. They're both serving Mystra, and they're disagreeing fervently as to how to do it. Well, one of the Seven Sisters will show up to put in her 2 cents worth, and then Mystra will show up and set them straight. So, I mean, it'll be clear that there's a lot of elbow room in how to serve Mystra, and there's a lot more to Mystra than what we've seen.
Sure.
The difficulty with showing you too much of the gods is they turn into a version of the Greek gods, overblown, boisterous mortals with larger foibles than us, but they often do stupid, whimsical things, apparently for no other reason than that we're needed to do so for the plot. And what that does is robs you of the awe that, you know, a deity should, like, everybody in the room should go, oh. And I don't mean because the deity's showing up in the walking talk. They should go, oh, when, for instance, if you worship Lysander, when the room takes on a rosy glow and nothing else happens, everybody should go, oh, it's Lysander. Oh, you've really done it now. You know, and we get away from that awe because we have the gods walking and talking. You know, and who knows? Again, it's all up in the air what will happen. I have seen the future of the realms, and there are some really, really cool things. Now, yes, there are some things that are going to upset anybody who's played in the realms for a long time in different ways. They're going to be different things because there's this person that won't like this thing, this person won't like that thing. But that also... It increases the illusion of realism, because in real life, things happen. And they're all not always happy things. They're always things we want to happen. But they happen anyway.
Mm-hmm.
We deal with it, get up, and go on. And that's one of the definitions that has been offered for being human. Humans are these stupid people who know how bad things are going to be, but they get up every day, put on clothes, and go into the office anyway. You know, they keep on.
Sure.
And that's... I'm just going to tell you, it's going to keep on. It's real.
Okay, so for those people who have been Realms fans and are really unsure about the new version of the Realms, how would you sell them on it? You know, how do you convince that person who's just incredibly pissed off that their three favorite gods are dead, that they should keep playing in that world? Or that their favorite continent blew up?
I would tell them two things. One is, there's nothing in what is done in the published realms that forces you to change the realms that you're playing in and having fun in right now.
Mm-hmm.
That's your realms. Everybody personalizes their realms by the mere act of playing in it. Everybody. My home realms campaign is different from the published realms. You know, there's no way of avoiding that. It's always going to be, different from the published realms. If you're having fun in your campaign right now, keep it. Stay right where you are if you want to. You know, there. I wouldn't say don't buy the new realm stuff. I would always look in the, like, because from the beginning of DMing, in the early days, and for me that was getting interested. Okay, I did look at the game in around 75 when it was the booklets, and I thought, there's not enough here. People are just going to argue about what happens in the story. I wasn't hooked till 1978 when the Monster Manual and the Player's Handbook in hardcover hit. I said, oh, this is really cool. Okay, but from then on, everybody in the hobby who played Dungeons & Dragons changed things for themselves.
Sure.
We all had house rules. We all had things. Player's Handbook has a page in there on weapon speed factors. Most people don't even know that because they looked at that page once and, flipped over it.
Mm-hmm.
Not everybody, but most people. They just didn't use it. Okay, so they were personalizing the things the same way. You go on, you use what you want. I would always look at the New Realm stuff because you can say, oh, that's cool, I can use this and I can use that out of it, even if I never move my realms. Or you can move your realms at any time in the future. It doesn't matter. What they've done is said, here's the timeline. We're now jumping over here. That's where they're printing new products from over here. It has an advantage. If you like what you're doing in the realms right now, but you hated the way that a novel would come in and change something, like kill off this ruler or change that kingdom, you don't have to worry about that now because it's happening 100 years in the future. Not now. It's not raining on your campaign right now. So, you know, I would say it's going to be the same thing you've always done with the realms. You buy the stuff for the cool things that you can use in your campaign, whether or not you're following the campaign in lockstep. And if you're, I don't think very many people at all would use the novels directly in their campaign. Like stop, and somebody will read the novel and hand it to the next one to read the next chapter. No, we all read it for fun outside the game. You can still do that. These are realm stories from 100 years in the future. And of course, there are many doors, many diverging paths. Your future may not be that future, but don't worry about it. You've got 100 years of playing time around the table before you'll know if you were right or not.
Sure.
And by then, who knows, maybe we'll all have new teeth and stuff.
So you mentioned your own Realms campaign. How different is your version of the Realms that you run from the published Realms?
Not really very different in the running of it, because when I run the realms, it's intensely character-based. So it's sort of like the difference between the published realms is sort of the state gazetteer version of the realms, a map. Here's the population. Here are the centers. If you're a tourist, you want to go take in the opera, go here. If you want to go see Indian caves, go there. You know, it's looking down on the realms and laying out stuff. When I'm playing in the campaign, I'm sitting just behind Torm's shoulder as he gets screwed up one more time.
Sure.
And, you know, the symbol throws a vase at him or whatever. You know, we're right down at that, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I'm doing the sort of All in the Family or MASH version of the realms. We're right close in focused on the characters.
So if, say, for example, the third edition realms, they took the Red Wizards of Thay in a little bit different direction and made them more of an economic and mercantile power.
Mm-hmm.
Is that something that plays out in your game? You know, are the Red Wizards that when you're running it also? Or?
Oh, sure. But the thing is, when I'm running it, you don't know why the Red Wizards are here. They're saying it's for trade. Right.
Sure.
And the big powerful ones, the ones that you know, quote, know, because Elminster's told you, that you are the ones you have to watch out for, they're not even there. There's some guys dressed as Red Wizards of Thay, you know. Some red shirts from the, you know, you're not talking to the captain and crew of the Enterprise. You're talking to a bunch of the ground support crew, the guys that get blown across the room. You know, who are these guys and why are they here? You know, so you can't, it becomes a setup rather than something you can trust in.
Sure.
You know.
Now, in all honesty, Elminster.
Mm-hmm.
How much of Elminster is Ed Greenwood?
Well, all of my characters are me in one sense or another. But Elminster is not me. Elminster is Elminster's far ruder than I'd ever be. He's far more unbuttoned than I would ever be. He's just one of a thousand roles that I've fairly well developed over the years that I've played. I am not Elminster.
But you don't show up at cons dressed up as your other characters very often.
I don't look good dressed as the symbol, I'm sorry. I just, you know, you would not pay money to see me as Storm.
Somebody would.
Well, maybe. I just don't cut it. You know, I don't have the sure. long silver hair. No. I dressed up as Elminster because TSR thought it would be cool and fun, and so did I. I've had a lot of fun playing Elminster. But no, it is a role. He is not my Mary Sue ego boo, as so many people love to say, because Elminster was originally, my original Elminster was the narrator. He was Ronald Reagan's character in Death Valley Days. At the beginning of each episode, it's like, well, hard time in the valley. This, and then the camera would go up over his shoulder and into the story. And then half an hour later, it would come back down again and said, so, see you next week. You know, that was Elminster. That's what his mouthpiece was for. He was telling us about the world. Nothing else. You know.
And he sort of developed into a character from that.
Well, yes. And he was my wave in my home campaign of telling the players they'd screwed up. You know.
Sure.
And to sort of give them a DM nudge without really giving them. That's why he was so irritating.
Mm-hmm.
They couldn't turn around and rely on him. Oh, Elminster would just tell us how to get out of this. No, I didn't ever want that to happen, because mm-hmm. that takes away all the fun. It for both ways. It saves their asses, which means they now can come to depend on that, but it also takes away the glory of having done it themselves, because it cheapens mm-hmm. everything they've done. It's sort of like saying, yeah, we didn't win that football game. Dad came onto the field and kicked the winning, you know, or
sure.
whatever. You know, it's like, okay, so you won, but you don't really feel like you
yeah.
won, you know.
Someone else won.
Yeah, exactly. And that's the way. I don't want Elminster to be an unreliable, irritating, completely. No, he's not me. But that's the role that seemed to be the most fun that the fans wanted. You see, there's two sorts of Elminster people. The vocal minority who hates his guts, and the silent majority that buys everything with Elminster in it twice as much as the non-Elminster mm-hmm. stuff. So obviously there are people who want to read more about this guy. Now, my role is to make sure that he is not a Gandalf / Merlin / whatever ripoff, that he is his own person.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing is, I am trying to show you bits of him that are different without giving too much away in each novel, that this guy is over 1,000 years old, this guy is completely insane, that this guy is hanging on, just doing what he thinks is right, and then there's the danger, and Vangerdehast in Cormyr is as a closer to the earth mortal
mm-hmm.
who's been doing this for a lot longer, a lot less time, is a more stark example of that, of how absolute power corrupts
mm-hmm.
and the old saw, if is the, does the end justify the means? Like, if I am, for instance, if I am Mr. Super Patriot saving the United States of America, is it okay if I do bad things to people and break the law or whatever to get to that end goal?
Mm-hmm.
And what happens if over time, centuries, I begin to think that I know what is good for the United States of America? In other words, I'm making the United States of America to be more and more in the mold of what I want, and I'm equating that with good. Is it okay to get there? If I get rid of this pesky Supreme Court and this Congress that's always in the way and the Senate full of idiots and this White House, why don't things just work out the way I want them to? Okay, now what if I'm wrong? What if I'm self-deluded? Who stops me? I'm not saying there are any right answers or wrong answers. I'm saying that's what I'm exploring with Elminster.
And that's sort of Elminster's roles.
Yeah.
Because he never asks anybody for permission to do anything.
No.
He's just off and doing it.
No, that's right. And Kelvin Blackstaff is the same way as Elminster, except Elminster would cut up the joke. Kelvin Blackstaff comes along as Captain James T. Kirk of the Starship Enterprise, and don't you forget it.
Well,
you know.
Kelvin almost seems to be moderated by his wife.
Well, yes.
Whereas
Kelvin,
Elminster
yeah.
is more of the philanderer. And not
sure.
Doesn't
sure.
have anybody to tie him down.
Elminster won't listen to anybody trying to tie him down, except
right.
maybe Mistra. He will banter with the Seven Sisters. Remember, he raised most of them.
Right.
So they're sort of like, oh, Willminster. And it's like, you're going, yeah, yeah, yeah. I remember you in diapers. You know, whereas Kelvin is more like, I saw what I saw. The boy drew the sword. If we don't follow rules, nothing makes any sense. But then, of course, you can turn that back on somebody. You know, like, mm-hmm. yeah, but you only choose the rules you want to choose, and you make up ones. Well, yes, that's what I do. Well, that doesn't make it right. Sure does. Somebody's got to make them. And, of course, the next line, which I can't use anymore because George Bush used, is, I'm the decider. Yeah. I can never use that line anymore because he took it. It was like, ah! Sure. But, I mean, that's what Kelvin's, you know, Kelvin's, I'll decide. Of course I'll decide. I'll decide. Because none of you know as much about the situation as I do. So, therefore, I'm the only one around here who can make the right decision. You'll all make the wrong decision. Which, of course, then he runs into the brick wall of, you know, the symbol saying, really? I disagree. And I know just as much. You know, it's see what I mean?
Yeah. So speaking of sort of brash philandering mm-hmm. in the realms,
mm-hmm.
There seem to be many events that would be considered in our social norms inappropriate.
Mm-hmm.
How much of that is influenced by personal experiences, and how much of that is just it's a fantasy world and things are different?
It's mainly a fantasy world and things are different. I was, in many, many cases over the years, I have been attempting to shake the reader or the gamer out of their, oh yeah, this will happen. Oh, because this is what always happens.
Right.
You know, the king will do this. And I was trying desperately to force you into better role-playing by, geez.
Having the king do something else.
Yeah, and now you better stop and think about it. Oh, wait a minute. Didn't think of this. You know, that moment in the movie Excalibur, you know, where Merlin says, I didn't foresee this. Well, that's what I want to happen over and over again. And so one of the cheap, easy ways, and yes, it's a cheap, easy way, but it's also a human way. I'm keeping it small scale. Rather than having Elminster blow up 45 castles and then turn around and say, so now what are you going to do? You know, I'm keeping it down on the venal, what everybody understands.
Well, sure. And there's, I mean, you mentioned Elminster's, how he'll banter with the Seven Sisters, but doesn't necessarily listen to what they have to say.
Mm-hmm.
If anything, in recent storytelling, it seems like if there was anybody that had a chance of tying him down, it would be the symbol.
Mm-hmm.
And then at the same time, he raised her from a child, and that starts getting a little bit off of what you would expect given our norms.
True, but you see, that's the other thing. I'm trying to sort of gently tell gamers, without rubbing their faces in it, this isn't your modern real world. I mean, every time I have design discussions about the gods, mm-hmm. every time I have discussions with fans about the gods, a large number of the fans, without really thinking about it, are thinking in terms of our modern real world where you worship one god. And their entire moral code of what they're talking to me about is grounded in that. They're thinking about that. And I'm trying to say, hey, it's a fantasy world. Things are different. Without them saying, yeah, I know it is. And I know they're dragons. But, you know, I want to just shift the discussion away from that.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, I would turn around and say, really? Well, okay, so you guys are somewhat uncomfortable with the fact that he's having sexual banter with a woman who is 800 years old, who 780 years ago was a rebellious teenager and he was looking after her. And 10 years before that, he was changing her diapers, except they didn't have diapers. Okay. And he's over 1,000 years old. Okay. How many real world people do you know that are in that situation? So how are you going to apply these morals again? You know, the point is it forces you to think about it all differently. And that's what I want you to have. So you start thinking about it and seeing them as people and saying, well, what would it be like to have buried not just everybody you knew when you were a kid, but entire kingdoms have gone, and you're the only one left. Who's going to tell you what's immoral? You know better. You've been around. You know, and the only thing that's going to tell you different is your deities,
mm-hmm.
not the priests, because you've outlived all of them, too. The deities. So unless the deity steps forward and says, you know, you really shouldn't be doing that, you're not going to listen to anybody else.
Sure.
You're in the category of making your own way now.
So, there are stories that have been out and about on the internet and what have you, involving things such as neighbors chopping wood. How much has that seeped into the storytelling. And maybe you want to tell that story, too, so people know where we're at.
Oh, the nude wood chopping scene where the storm is chopping wood at her farmhouse, clad fetchingly in boots and a rag tied around her forehead to keep the sweat from falling into her eyes. That is based on real-world things where people were... where it was intensely hot and humid, sort of like it is in Columbus right now, mm-hmm. and somebody was chopping firewood. And, okay, why did I put that scene in there? I put that scene in there to underscore how completely uncaring she is about prudery, conventional mores. I mean, she's in the middle of her farm, which is overgrown. The only people who are going to see her in the woods cutting this are visitors / trespassers, mm-hmm. you know, visitors who come. She isn't expecting any visitors. So anybody who, except Harpers. And for Harpers, it's sort of one of their shock, it's one of the shock therapy treatment things of, you know, okay, you know what you signed up for?
It's hazing in the
yeah,
Harpers.
Yeah, it's hazing in the Harpers, yeah. It's like, oh, shit, man, you know, we got to her farmhouse and holy cadoodle. Oh. Yes, and how did you react then? I'd rather not say. Yes, that's what I said 30 years ago when it was done to me. You know that's what you got to think. This is all the time. She just doesn't care. I mean, she was hot. She'd rather be comfortable. Now, I do not try this at home. Because if you're not a good woodcutter, you have left your body unprotected. If your axe or hatchet glances off, you're going to... there's nothing to stop it carving into your skin. So don't try it at home. It was stupid. But that's the other thing. These people have been alive for 100 years. They don't care. You know, if I die, so what? I've seen it all. That's the other side of the chosen, you know.
Fearlessness.
Well, not just that. You've gone into uncaring. Kill me now. I've seen everything. You know, and okay, are they sane? No, they're not. I keep underscoring that. People don't put the two and two together. They go, yes, Ed, but she's got no clothes on. Yeah, she's insane. Yeah, that's not the point. She's got no clothes on. That's disgusting. Really? It is? How do you know that? Well, I find it... well, okay. That's fine. Well, that's why I hardly ever mention it. But doesn't she find it disgusting? No, she's insane. You don't get it yet, do you?
I think people have a hard time seeing a character as both a hero in their stories and insane.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's where the disconnect is.
And that's what I'm trying to explore. You see, when I... if you look back to the very beginning of my realm's fiction, Spellfire and so on, what I'm trying to show is heroes aren't guys who walk around in tights with spotlights on their heads. Heroes are you and me. That, again, okay, there have been lots of moments in Spellfire, and some of them got edited out, but it's the individual person who stands up for that moment and does the right thing. To use the movie Excalibur, Patrick Stewart's character, Uriens, you know, when they're all yelling to him, "What are you? You're gonna be ruled by a motherless boy?" And he says, "I saw what I saw. The boy drew the sword." So he's gonna stand up for his principles, no matter how much it costs him.
Mm-hmm.
That's heroism. So I want to underscore the message over and over again that heroes aren't these special people. Heroes are us, everybody in the society, and heroism can be very small acts. Like, oh, this guy overpaid me. I'm going to go back and give him his change. You know, mm-hmm. or, well, that doesn't belong to me. I shouldn't keep it. Sure. I should turn it in. You know, it doesn't have to be big, bold things where the world hangs in the balance. Sure. And that's what I'm trying to show. Don't, because if you say that's a hero, you're also saying that's a hero, so I don't have to do anything. The hero will take care mm-hmm. of it. You're saying in society, oh, well, my job is just to keep my head down.
Mm-hmm.
The heroes will take care of it.
Sure. So, and that's one of the larger, I guess, criticisms, I guess, that comes out about the realms, that you have these very powerful, special people that can do a lot.
Mm-hmm.
How do I, or how would you recommend to listeners, how do you take a Chosen of Mystra, put them into your game, you know, because part of it comes off a little bit insincere or disingenuous to have Elminster say, you guys need to go off on this mission to accomplish this task. Well, okay, but you could do it in 5 minutes. Why don't you just do it?
Okay, yeah, I, as a DM, I would never be using Elminster like that. I would never be having Elminster be, you know, Mr. Big. Mm-hmm. Your assignment today is do this. You know, it wouldn't be Elminster. It would be more like the local burghers get together and say, could you guys do something about this? Because we don't want Elminster to notice it. We don't want Elminster coming around. Holy shit. You know, he's just next door in that hut. Can we, like, take care of this wyvern in a hurry?
Because if Elminster does it, something might blow up.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. Elminster will want all our daughters again. Or he'll blow up half the town like last time. Or whatever. You know. So my answer to those people would be, okay, I think over the years there has been, because of the nature of what we publish, there's been too much attention on the gods. Like every time we have a new edition of the game, there's all the gods and their avatars. What's that? I want details of the temple. I don't want you to see the gods every 5 seconds. I would not have emphasized the big characters nearly as much as other people have done. It wasn't my choice to write Elminster novels. Given my druthers, I would never have written a novel starring Elminster. He'd be referred to in it by people in the way I just said, oh, don't tell Elminster about this. Who's that guy over there? Oh, that's Elminster. Let's move on hastily. I would be telling stories about the little guys. You know, my first adventure. You know, how I left home, became a rich adventurer. Not. You know, or whatever it would be. It would be individual stories. Elminster just happens. Okay? I want a Realms gamer to know that there are people in the world of this huge high level. So you have somebody bigger and stronger. So you have somebody to aspire to. Or knock down if you want. But there's always somebody more powerful. I want them to know there are people like that in the world. But I would not have featured them as much.
Sure.
But of course, what happens when you're telling stories, particularly novels, is, oh, give me another Elminster
book.
People
want to know.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, and
yeah.
As a 20-year Realms fan, I've been playing games and running games and reading novels in the Realms for 20 years. I will buy and read every Elminster novel because I'm interested in what's going to happen to the character.
Right. Me too.
And at the same time, running games in the Realms for 20 years, I don't think he's ever been more than mentioned.
That's right.
Elminster wrote this book once. It has some information that might help you with your quest.
Sure.
You
know? And that's the way I would use Elminster. When the original Knights of Mithranor in Shadowdale, they would go and try to talk to Elminster all the time. No, let's get information out of Elminster. And they'd get endless cups of tea with Leo.
Oh, yeah, I made Leo a real jerk.
Yeah, exactly.
You got to fill out that paperwork before I can let you see it.
That's right. And Elminster would occasionally want to say, I see you all still alive. So what have you been doing? Has anybody made bail yet? You know, and then he'd wander on. He was just the most annoying guy. And he was like, oh, I would love to talk to you about that, but boop. He's just teleported away. Boop. Oh, I'm back. Sorry. But I've got to get that scepter now. It's terrible. I'm very busy. Things going on and say, you know, boop. It's like, Elminster, it's about your boop. Yes. Cat. Yeah, what about my cat? Oh, never mind now. Boop. You know. And then he wouldn't come back. And then Larry would say, sometimes it's months, you know, you better go home.
All right.
You know, rather, so, I mean, he would not be at your beck and call. He would be this bumbling comic relief who was more than a bumbling comic relief, but that would be it. He wouldn't be in play.
Which is a really interesting character for a novel, but yeah.
Yeah.
You got to be careful how you use him in a game.
Sure, and largely in my games, he wasn't in there. I mean, to people who said, oh, well, there's nothing I can do in the Realms because there's these super characters who do it all. Really? You got a really lousy DM then. I mean, what? The whole point of the Realms is it's supposed to feel like a real living place. So it isn't just your players who do stuff. The players have to feel that other people in the world, kings, rulers, are doing stuff. But at the same time, your dungeon master has to be sympathetic to the fact that he's running adventures for you. So you guys should be the center stage, just not the only wheels. You shouldn't get the feeling that the Realms is lifeless with all the lights off, except when you walk on stage. It should feel like a real place, but it's still supposed to be centered on your adventures. So any super character that's getting in the way of your adventure shouldn't be there. Just take them away.
So how much did the new Realms, with what is in the campaign setting, look and feel like a detailed living world? I mean, I know in the third edition version, there were maps with commerce and all kinds of stuff all over the place. You know, lots of details that made it feel like a real world and had to work on realistic assumptions and that kind of stuff. Is that going to be there? Because I know they're only talking about a possible handful of books supporting the realms at this point.
And that's the problem. The moment you only have a handful of books, you don't have enough space between the covers to cover everything.
Yeah, right.
And from what's been done so far on the New Realms, there's a lot more elbow room for adventures to be told. In other words, there's things that are different and things that there's less that's spelled out in particular areas of the realms. I think you'll find that Cormyr and Waterdeep haven't really changed that much. I mean, yes, they've gone ahead 100 years, and there are minor cosmetic changes to everything, like different person on the throne in Cormyr, you know. But it's basically the same place. Other parts of the realms, lots of things have changed.
Mm-hmm.
And there may not be much more than a few paragraphs on them because we just don't have room.
Sure.
Which means there's a lot more elbow room for you. Now, in theory, you'll be reading more and more stuff online as articles come out. But so far, there are articles. You know, let's do an article on this. Let's do an article on that. There may be your area that you, and by your area, I mean, you find this cool thing in the middle of the Forgotten Realms campaign setting about some place that we've never mentioned before, and you say, oh, cool, tell me more about that. There may be nothing more about that. It may be left to you for years, just like we had at the beginning of the realms. There's more of an, so, I mean, I can't really give full details because it hasn't been published yet, and because I'm not a staff member. I'm not there to read. I know what I wrote. I know it was sent to me. We talked over stuff. Stuff got rewritten. More stuff got in it. And I don't know what the final end result is. I haven't seen it. I know what I think is in it. You know, but, you know.
You've seen an outline and you wrote part of it.
But. Yeah. No, I've seen a little bit more than outline, but it might change. You know, it hadn't been edited at the point I saw it.
Sure. So how much new crunch bits could we expect in that?
Crunch?
Rules and
yeah.
Classes and are we going to see more subgroups of elves come back? Or is it just
I don't know.
With, okay.
From what I've seen so far, these books were more fluff than crunch.
Okay.
To use those two.
Sure.
Those are somewhat, you know, those are handy terms, but they're somewhat distorting. More and more of the core realm rules stuff in fourth edition is in the rules.
Mm-hmm.
And more and more story stuff. I would prefer to use the terms rules and story. Mm-hmm. There's more story in the Forgotten Realms campaign setting. There's more rules in the core rule books. Okay, from what I've seen, you won't see tons and tons of detailed quote rules stuff.
Okay,
but there is also a player's guide.
Right.
Okay, so you may see some stuff
there.
And you know, I wish to re-emphasize, I'm saying may. No, I'm not a staff member, okay? I haven't seen the final stuff of all this stuff. We're still telling stories in the realms. That's where my love is.
Right, sure. One of the design assumptions in 4th edition that was sort of discussed with the articles that were coming out before the books were released was this concept of the points of light.
Mm-hmm.
You're familiar with the points of light?
Yes.
How well do the points of light fit your vision of what the realms were before and now after 4th edition? I mean, did points of light sort of fit your vision of what the realms was all about before?
Believe it or not, it did, with a few exceptions. And the few exceptions were small areas in Cormyr, in Silvery Moon, and very small areas in Waterdeep, like inside certain noble villas, if the noble family wasn't too Machiavellian. points of light actually fit a lot of places in the realms. It just didn't seem to, as more and more detail came on about merchants and caravans. Everybody got the idea, oh, this is cool. But in some way, to use a real-world analogy, you can be in a very wealthy city in the real world, and there's huge crime. And people just sort of don't mention it, you know. It's part of living here. And you still go to see the shows and, you know, there's tall buildings and all that stuff. And you listen to the, you know, politics and so on. And it's all bright and breezy and everything. But it's still the stuff going on. I think from the very beginning, the realms has in effect been points of light because otherwise there would be no need for adventurers. You know, there wouldn't be adventurers. They would all be outlaws because everything would be neat and ordered and, you know, in some extent, in some small areas in the realms, that's still true. I mean, you go into town and local inn, you're asking if there are any dragons, and the guy says, oh, we don't have much call for adventurers in these parts. We don't like people with swords walking around, you know. The king's peace is enough for us. And then the innkeeper sort of jerks his thumb in the direction of four or five soldiers in uniform who are drinking at the end table and says, they carry the swords around here. We obey the law. I suggest you do the same. Or something of the sort, you know. So there are... the points of light has actually fit the realm since the beginning. It just hasn't felt like it. And there's nothing wrong with it not feeling like it, because that's what you're selling to people. Mm-hmm. Even in the real world, everything's going to be better. We're all going to be richer. You're all going to, you know, your parents work hard to send you to college so you can be better. You can aspire to what they didn't have. Mm-hmm. Well, in actual fact, the society may not be all trending upwards, but there's still again, to use the real world, the American dream, mm-hmm. is the vision, the ideal that's being sold to people, so they'll all buy into this. Okay, I'll pay my taxes and obey the laws, and everything will be better. Okay, it may not. I mean, there are times when it was trending highly upward, but it may not stay that way. I mean, people jumped out of windows in 1929, and the stock market crash. And until then, the world is their oyster. They were going to be so much richer than all the people back in England. This was the promised land, man. I mean, they called it that, the promised land. This is where, you know, you could eat steaks so thick you can choke on them, which you couldn't afford if you were a peasant back in Europe. You didn't get the steak. You got the grass. You know, that sort of thing. And to some extent, that is hold true in the realms, too. We sell this ideal of wealth and prosperity and everything going. But, of course, 30 years of adventuring tells us you have to pull the swords out an awful lot, awful many times to make those things happen.
Great. So anything else you want to share with Tome listeners, or Jeffrey has any questions?
Yeah, far away. I kind of want to ask about fans, because I spend a lot of time listening to fans, and some of them are very nice people, and some of them are very annoying people. How do fans influence the development of a game or the realms, and do you differentiate between those fans who just enjoy the realms and those fans who just sort of kill the joy for themselves and everyone by being obnoxious?
I try to listen to everybody, because the one thing that, okay, to a company, and I would hope any company, I'm not pointing any fingers at any gaming company, I would hope any company would follow this. Your fans are your consumers. And the fans that dare to talk to you, to open their mouths and say something, might be a subset of fans who are being very, pushy. But they're being very brave. They're actually opening their mouths and talking to you. They care enough to talk. You may disagree with them. You may agree with them. You may think they're nuts. You may think they're obsessed. You know, if some guy is talking to you for 3 hours about the geology of some small part of the realms, you may be going, holy cadoodle. But it matters to him, okay? So any company should listen to their consumers. In the same way, I listen to all the fans. Because for one thing, these people have... They're the people who, down the end of the line, have paid for everything I've gotten out of gaming. They paid the freight for it. So I owe it to listen to them, number one. Number two, for each fan, it's their moment to talk to somebody, to say thanks, or to say, hi, I think you're doing this wrong. Or, hey, I really like this other thing you did. Cool. It would be churlish of me not to listen to them, okay? Just as a human being. Mm-hmm. As a designer, I want to hear from everybody, because the one thing that happens in any design situation is you get tunnel vision, because you're surrounded by other people who are thinking the realms the way you are, who are designers, and somebody comes out of left field and says, so when they poop, where do they put it? And the designers all look at each other and go, oh, okay. And I'm just making up, because as a matter of fact, before the realms got published, I had already worked out where all the dragon poop went. That's what made the realms different. And if you went in the dungeon, where does the shit go? And I remember that. It's like, and I remember that very distinctly. One of the TSR designers at the time said, there's this crazy guy up in Canada. He figures out where the shit goes in his dungeons.
I just love the fact that you just said that you know where the dragon poop is.
Yep, but I mean, somebody, any fan can give you a different perspective on something, and you should listen to all of them. I mean, There's some things I write in books, and I don't realize that they've been misinterpreted by somebody, which means it's my fault because I should have written it more clearly. There were times when I had written things that somebody took in a sexual way. Oh, that Elminster's doing this. No, he's not. Where did I write that? Here, right here, and I'm reading a comic. That doesn't mean that at all. But to that person, it did. Mm-hmm. So I had to, you know, make it clearer next time. Mm-hmm. So as a writer and as a designer, I'm learning. And this, when you're doing a fantasy world, even more so than when you're just a writer. I mean, if you're Anne McCaffrey writing Pern books, just books, I know there are Pern games, but you're not having anything directly to do with the games. You are still have an intense relationship with your fans. But when it's a role-playing setting where the fans are playing in the game, because of the nature of role-playing, and Anne McCaffrey can control the story, I can't. Therefore, fans will come up, they'll get into a situation and they'll say, okay, we were on a raft and it started to break up. Where would the logs go? Okay, that's not something that Anne McCaffrey would probably ever have to deal with, but I have to, so therefore it behooves me to listen to them because they are, in effect, my playtesters for my baby forever. All of them. They're constantly playtesting my world. So on that level, I owe it not just to them as common courtesy, but because they make the realms better for everybody by saying, hey, did you think about the logs? And I'm going, oh, yeah. And I add that little bit, you know. Some people who can be annoying, and people are people, but it's sort of like the old saw about the guy in the company who's a vice president who's made up his mind what he's going to do doesn't want to hear from anybody, and the other vice president says to him, "You fool, we can't pay for those sort of marketing surveys. Listen to them. Shit, man, they're willing to come and tell us for free all this stuff." Mm-hmm. Go out there and listen to them. Okay, and that's the situation I find myself in with the realms. I should listen to everybody to find out what works, what didn't work, what they liked more of, what they didn't want more of, what upset them, what I presented wrongly, what the company, when in its editing, got wrong on how they emphasized something, put it out. Was it a good idea to have these miniatures? Was it not a good idea? Should we have had more maps this? Did people get lost in the city? Well, shouldn't we have develop the city more if we were setting 16 novels there? Like, I mean, given a gaming product, I meant that people could walk around, or was that a mistake? Everything. I'm not saying they're right or wrong answers, and I'm making up hypothetical things, but I mean, that's what we use and should use every fan for. And the other thing is, for us, it's really our payoff, too. You know, when a fan says, hey, you did this and it changed my life, or, I'd like you to meet my little baby daughter, whom I named after your character. Hi. I mean,
as long as you're not the father.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, there are people wandering. There are lustrials walking around this world now.
Yeah.
There are chandrels. There are lyrals. Heavy responsibility time. Anyway, that's yeah.
So. You like to listen to fans as much as possible. Where can fans actually go if they want to grab your attention about something?
Well, at a convention I'm at, or I try and keep up at Candlekeep, www.candlekeep.com, and there's a questions for the Sages section, and or Chamber of Sages section, mm-hmm. excuse me, and then a questions for Ed Greenwood subsection. We do a new thread each year because there are so many questions,
sure.
And I try and answer them. And this has been going on that venue since 2004. There are questions left from 2004 I haven't answered, but I also answered questions that were just posed last week. If it's something I can quickly answer, I will.
Sure.
And there are all sorts of questions, but if you just want to ask me anything, I have no secrets.
Sure. So if people are hunting around on Candlekeep, what's your name on there?
I do not post on Candlekeep.
Oh, you don't post?
One of my players, called the Hooded One, takes, copies all of the questions into emails, emails them to me. I write an answer. I have a constant pile of emails, you know. I write an answer and send it to her, and she posts it.
Okay.
So if you see a posting by the Hooded One, that's one of my original players.
Okay. Who's still playing in your game?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yes.
You, Do you still have a lot of your original players that,
yes,
that you game with?
Oh, yeah. I have all my original players. We don't play very often, though. It's sure. down to a couple times a year because we're all over the world now.
Are they the basis of characters that we've seen in products?
One or two of the Company of Crazed Ventures, the original Waterdeep, and many of the Nightsmith Draenor are their player characters.
Are their characters?
Oh, yeah. They actually had to sign release forms years ago.
Oh.
Which TSR typed up and sent to me. But more than that, it's me. I play all the other characters.
Okay.
I do all the non-player character stuff.
Feel strange writing a novel with Torm in it?
Oh, sure.
And it not being your character, and are you portraying this character right, or is you know?
Well, what I did with the Nightsmith Draenor, I set out saying, I can't paraphrase our campaign. Because our home realm campaign does not have a narrative line. It has 46,000 subplots going on at a time, and they choose which ones they want to do this week. You can't tell novels like that. Because it literally, at the end of the book, you'd say, what's going on? What did I just read? Nothing happened. Well, thousands of things happened, but nothing. There was no development.
Right.
Nothing went anywhere.
Nothing began, climax, and then ended.
Yeah. So these are going to be fictionalized accounts of the Nightsmith Draenor. You know, the fictional accounts of the Starship Enterprise. Okay, that's what I'm doing, you know.
Ironically, fan fiction of your players? Is that sort of what you're doing?
In effect, because one of the things I keep circling back to is making sure that whenever I can remember precise dialogue that was said, put it in the novel.
Sure.
In their words. Whenever I, precise things they did, little pratfalls, little deliberate subterfuges, how they dressed, stuff like that, and described it to me, I put it in.
Sure. So what edition of the game are you playing with those players?
Second. You see, I believe strongly that the Dungeon Master's job is to entertain the players.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the ways of doing that is that we all have agreement on what we want to do. So we voted on everything. Okay.
Sure.
For a long time, they were playing first edition, second edition bards, and stuff like that. They vote what will happen.
Sure.
Okay, vote if the Time of Troubles will be in the campaign. We haven't reached the Time of Troubles yet in our chronological campaign. They decide that.
They've got a long ways before they see the spell plug there.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, really, yeah. Oh, yeah. And, I mean, some of them have retired already.
Sure.
Doust and so on have retired back to being priests.
Mm-hmm.
In the church hierarchy, rather than going and being adventurers.
Mm-hmm.
So it'll be their children. Or maybe their grandchildren who will hit the spell plague as rebellious teenagers.
Yeah.
You know, so yeah. But yeah, it's basically second edition because that's their choice. That's not my design decision. Oh, I'm repudiating third and fourth. No, that's what they wanted.
Sure. Anything else? Not over here. Anything else you want to say?
Keep playing in the realms. Happy to meet all of you. Let's do this again. Let's talk often.
Well, there's Ed Greenwood at Origins 2008. Now a promo for Icosa Head Phil. I can't pronounce the name of this show. But it's a new podcast focused on 4th edition D&D, and it's all about actual play recordings, sort of like the ones we had of Keep on the Shadowfell around the time that 4th edition was launched, from Gamer's Haven. But unlike most actual play, it still has segments in it, where he sets up the story, gives you the actual play from his game group, and then discusses the props and tools they use in each session. But more important than that, it's all done in about an hour or less. An actual play that is an hour or less. It's pretty much the awesome. I've always sort of enjoyed actual play, but never been willing to dedicate the time to it. But I can dedicate the time to listen to an hour-long show a week.
That's what I'm talking about.
Need more D&D? It doesn't take a perception check. Just visit d20.heardworld.com. That's d20.heardworld.com and subscribe to the Icosahedrophilia podcast featuring actual D&D 4th edition gameplay.
Okay, well that's episode 82. And hey, why don't you email the show at thetomeshow@gmail.com? And don't forget the forums. We have some great free resources there. For gaming sheets, for characters, powers, whatever. Also, you can help the show get noticed with reviews or votes on various sites, but more than that, get out there and tell people about the show. Maybe ask your local game shop if they'll play the show on their radio during the day for people to listen to. Also, Don't forget to consider checking out the Tome's Amazon store for products discussed on this show and more. The show gets part of the proceeds, and that helps keep us on the air. And once again, you can find all of this at thetomeshow.com. And of course, the Tome is a founding member of the Vorpal Network at vorpalnetwork.com. Check out the forums, geek news, Twitter information for the network, and if you're looking to sell something, a way to contact me about advertising. Yet another way for us to try and pay the bills for this hobby of podcasting and bring you all of the listeners some free content. Links for things mentioned on the show can be found in the show notes on the website at thetomeshow.com. This has been episode 82, Ed Greenwood at Origins 2008 of The Tome.